The implementation of DORA made itself felt all over Ireland and sometimes in regard to Cork. For example, in February 1917, I'm jumping back a bit here, it was under DORA that McCurtain, McSweeney, were simply deported without trial to England, and they couldn't take part in the analysis and forming of Republican Sinn Féin. It was used, and used actively, but in May 1918, when Lord French was appointed as Lord Lieutenant, things changed dramatically. It assumed a more military character, the British regime. It also assumed a more unionist character, with Walter Long central to the relationship between Dublin Castle and the War Cabinet. You're moving into a situation where the beginning of a military rule by the British, and in the midst of the conscription crisis, the Irish made a similar response. Faced by the threat of conscription, there was a Mansion House conference in which all parties joined: Sinn Féin, Irish Party, Labour, and they declared that conscription was a declaration of war on the Irish people. Now, French at the same time was making his own declaration of war. He asserted he was going to Ireland for the purpose of military order and combating German intrigue and coming as a military viceroy at the head of a quasi-military government. His plans for 4 Air Force squadrons and 4 concentrated bodies of troops at Dublin, the Curra, Cork and Limerick put Ireland on a war footing some 6 months before the traditional date for the start of the War of Independence. Now, the police played an integral part in these plans. On the night of 17th-18th of May 1918, under a proclamation of Lord French, under the terms of DORA, hundreds of suspect revolutionaries were arrested in a combined operation by police and army. These were the men that were in prison, actually in prison, when Hart makes the reference to people being locked up. By the first week in November, there were 100 prisoners in England. French, during that time, from May on, was after the arrest, he continued with the severe repression restriction on places. Certain places, Cork City is proclaimed in June. A military council is set up. And then all the organisations are proclaimed as dangerous. Sinn Féin, dangerous. Cumann na mBan, dangerous. Gaelic League, dangerous. And that's the way he was evolving. Now, all of these proclamations, as if to provoke Republicans, concluded with the word, "God save the King." Now, interestingly enough, of all that phase, and during that phase, Hart asks and he analyses, when did the war begin, and so on. And in a sense, creditably, he's trying to analyze, what date can you give to date the War of Independence? Having said that, he has nothing to say about the role of Lord French in these events, when clearly the British are moving into a very significant war effort. They didn't change it. In January 1919, when Tipperary incident broke out, they simply declared Tipperary a special military area with a competent military authority. Anyway, to finish this particular bit, it was in this context of censorship, intimidation, imprisonment, that Sinn Féin returned 73 seats in the general election. At the first meeting of Dáil Éireann, the reply, "imprisoned by the foreigner," was given in response to 36 names. For Cork, the following people returned: James Joseph Walsh, Leon Durocher, David Kent, Terence McSweeney, Patrick O'Keefe, Thomas Hunter, Michael Collins, Diarmaid Lynch, and Sean Hayes. You have Dáil Éireann appearing, and people, historians, Hart, Foster, they quibble. There's no real electoral mandate. They never mention the terrible difficulty to run an election with everybody in prison and so on. But despite that, and this is important for the structure of the volunteers and the IRA, when Dáil Éireann met 21st of January, it gave formal expression to to its ideals and the Declaration of Independence, message to the free nations of the world, and the democratic program. When it made formal application to be represented at the Paris Peace Conference, it did so, in the words of President Wilson, as a small nation rightly struggling to be free. The British War Cabinet, which remained in being, and this is significant, until October 1919, refused to recognise Dáil Éireann and combined with President Wilson to prevent the Irish case being heard at Paris. Peter Hart has adopted the same perspective as the British War Cabinet. Now, he's been quite explicit on the matter, and fortunately, our good chairman here was partly responsible for Peter Hart declaring himself. Writing in the Irish Times of the 22nd of July 1998, in response to a letter from Páirc Ó Cuanáin, Hart affirmed, "Nor were members of the IRA protected by the Hague Convention, the basis for the law of war on land. The British government and its forces were not at war in this sense. To be recognised as belligerent soldiers, the guerrillas would have had to be fighting for a responsible established state, wear a recognisable uniform or emblem, carry their arms openly, and not disguise themselves as civilians. None of these conditions applied." End of quotation from Peter Hart. Now, here I think we get to the crux of the problem. Hart, as did the British government, accepts the status quo. Ireland is an internal domestic issue to be dealt with by the United Kingdom. He cannot comprehend a just war fought on the principles of national freedom, even if that abstract concept had been given precise political expression in the proclamations of Dáil Éireann. When therefore he states that violence, I believe, is best measured in terms of its victims, he does so in a non or apolitical context. Statistics are all important for him. There is no right or wrong, no good or bad, no chance of the IRA being deemed freedom fighters as opposed to insurrectionary guerrillas. No chance, indeed, of the hundreds of Sinn Féiners imprisoned without trial in 1918, or of the countless others in the War of Independence enjoying the status of victim. When he wrote his preface to Abbott's book on police casualties in the war, he described the policemen that died as victims. I don't think he has quite the same approach to either volunteers, IRA, or ordinary Irish citizens. Now, I've gone on a long time. I've been asked to focus on sectarianism and that issue, and I'll try to deal with that. The particular thing is I've tried to make references to Cork as well in this. It was only in April 1919 that these people that had been imprisoned were released and could actually meet as Dáil Éireann as a fairly large body and attempt to do something. Now, their main concern was not actually to conduct a war effort. They were trying to do something. But their main effort was to construct a counter-state, to really get an alternative government to Dublin Castle rule in Ireland. And Arthur Mitchell has written very well on that. The most important initiative was the launching of the internal loan on the 21st of August 1919, launched by Michael Collins as Minister of Finance and designed to raise £250,000 for the administration of Dáil Éireann. It was publicly announced at the Mansion House, and Collins then secured a spectacular coup by filming eminent donors, Sinn Féiners, receiving their bond certificates from him outside Pierce's school at St. Enda's. It was filmed, sent to America, used to great effect, and the young Sinn Féiners took it to Dublin, went into all the cinemas, closed the cinemas down, unless they showed the film. So it was a great propaganda coup, and Harry Boland wrote back to America telling Collins that he was a great movie star. But it was a positive effort. But the British government reacted angrily and determined to crush it. Any effort to create a counter-state was crushed. It was a bit provocative. The form and the advertisement for the loan said as follows: issued by, or in the name of, the Government of the Republic, Eamon de Valera was President of the Republic and Michael Collins was Minister of Finance. So that's the way it was. And they then continued to raid for Collins, raid the offices and everything. I just make the point that the assassination of individual policemen, pretty well, certainly by Michael Collins' squad, only took place when raids had taken for Michael Collins and the Doyle Aron office. And when this particular event happened on the 10th of December 1919, Doyle Aron was declared by Dublin Castle Lord Lieutenant to be a dangerous association, and the loan was proclaimed to be seditious, and all organisations listed as dangerous were suppressed. This would be in Sinn Féin clubs, volunteers, Cumann na Mór, and the Gaelic League. Arthur Griffith, reviewing the situation with all the suppression, said, "The English government in Ireland has now proclaimed the whole Irish nation. Now, in the midst of these difficulties, Terence McSweeney in Cork did manage to get the loan going, and cooperation with Michael Collins, the Mid-Cork produced a very great success, and Collins informed McSweeney in July 20, "I am of the opinion the prompt responses in Mid-Cork was the greatest factor in making the loan a success." And that was done. It was planned that the loan would help all sorts of industries, forestry, whatever. It was also intended to help the National Land Bank. The bank, I'll say something, the bank is important. The National Land Bank was registered on the 2nd of December 1919. Robert Barton, Minister of Agriculture, was in charge of the project under the guidance of Michael Collins. The plan was acquisition of land, the development of farms by native Irish farmers. Barton himself, as you know, was a Protestant, and more than that, he'd been an officer in the British Army who had been responsible for looking after prisoners after the 1916 rising. But he is given this position of preeminence. I'd suggest it provides a very clear indication that it was not the intention of Doyle Aron to drive Protestants from the land. Far from it. There's no room in the structure of this for Peter Hart's idea of ethnic cleansing of Protestants, as if to consolidate or endorse that view. Among the directors of the bank were Erskine Childers, Edward Millington Singh, and Lionel Smith Gordon. All three were Protestants, and Smith Gordon, who was appointed manager, was a graduate of Eton and Oxford, as well as being a founder active member of Sir Horace Plunkett's Cooperative Society. The foundation of the bank was directly linked to the plans of Doyle Aron to renew Irish agriculture and industry. Although these endeavours were undertaken by representatives of all classes and creeds, they were immediately opposed by Dublin Castle. So we have this effort, Protestants at the centre of it, to sort out the land problem, and Dublin Castle reacts. Barton arrested under Dora, January 1920, deported to Portland Prison. Cork meeting, January 1920, organised by the Irish Industrial Commission. This is in Cork. Among those present were Smith Gordon, Sir Henry Gretton Bellew, George Russell, A.E., another Protestant from the co-ops, Thomas Johnson, Treasurer of the Irish Trade Union Congress, and a person called Rob, Ulster linen manufacturer. A delegate from the British Labour Party, who witnessed the police action, declared that they could see no reason for the action unless it be part of a deliberate policy calculated to hinder the development of Irish industries. There were other efforts to suppress the bank, the appointment of a man called Alan Bell, detective, who was going to get at the financial resources, and he did, until Michael Collins had him shot on the 26th of March. Childers came to Cork as part of the plan to renew the land bank, and he began a tour in March, 23rd of March. In Cork he met John Horgan, Dowdle, I forget the Christian name, Dowdle, Professor Alfred O'Reilly, Liam de Rochester, Terence McSweeney and Father Dominic. And I suggest these court names witness to a gathering of diverse voices, national, intellectual, labour and business. On his return to Dublin, concerned with the land bank and other issues, he meets Alice Stopford Green, George Russell again, and Albina Broderick, the sister of the Earl of Middleton. She may be known to you. She was an extremely significant lady, the Honourable Albina Broderick, who took the name of Gopnik de Bruder. She's a particular value for Cork. She became a dedicated worker in the cause of the Irish Republic, and at her death she left her estate for the benefit of the Republicans, as they were, in 1919 and 1921. Money was granted by Michael Collins for the land bank to set up branches in Cork, Tralee, Limerick and elsewhere, and at the very end of his life, to the very end, Collins retained an interest in the bank. His diary records that he had a meeting with the manager of the National Land Bank in Cork at 11:45 a.m. on the 21st of August 1922, the day before he died. That day he was staying in this hotel. It doesn't record whether he met the manager in the hotel, but it's significant that was one of the last things he did. It's connected with a very generous cooperation, Protestants, whatever, to sort out the land, and connected with this hotel. A few other examples of cooperation. An interesting one, I think, is this. Lloyd George, at a cabinet meeting, 4th of August 1920, met a delegation of businessmen from Cork and Dublin. The group, introduced by Sir Stanley Harrington, industrialist with banking and shipping interest in Cork, and Richard Beamish, who would be known to everybody here, though, the name and the company. He prefaced his remarks, Beamish, in presenting his case for Dominion Home Rule, with the observation, the Protestants of the South had no fear on grounds of creed, and he maintained that the proposals had been agreed upon by all creeds. So you have this particular formal statement to Lloyd George with his cabinet that there was accord. This was made at the time. There was terrible conflict of pogroms in the north of Ireland. And that provoked or promoted a tremendous number of letters to the Irish Times and the Freeman's Journal protesting by Protestants that they were being very well treated in the south. George Russell, A.E., he wrote in, I'll just give one example. Most significant for this area, a man called J.W. Biggs from Bantry, County Cork. He stated 22nd of July 1920, I feel it is my duty to protest very strongly against this unfounded slander of intolerance on the part of our Catholic neighbours. And in so doing, I'm expressing the feelings of very many Protestant traders in West Cork. I have been resident in Bantry for 43 years, during 33 of which I have been engaged in business, and I have received the greatest kindness, courtesy and support from all classes and creeds in this country. In Munster, where Catholics outnumber Protestants by 18-1, a very large number of the leading traders are Protestants, who are being supported by Catholics, and greatest goodwill exists between them. Very significant. What happened to poor Mr. Biggs? A few days after the letter appeared in the press, the business premises of Mr. Biggs, valued at £30,000, were burnt to the ground by the local constabulary. Erskine Childers reflected on the pogroms and drew a conclusion for the future. He described the pogroms as sectarian persecution in which the helpless minorities of Catholics were hunted like game. He traced the root of the problem to England's view of Ireland as a strategic outpost. With such a mentality, he argued, it was natural to arm its unionist inhabitants against their fellow countrymen.